Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, June 12th, the fully responsive edition. I'm June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ section, and since Hannah is out, we are once again all packed into the Slate New York studio. I'm here with Slate's senior editor, Jessica Winter. Hello, Jessica.
Hey, June.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hey, Noreen.
Hi, June.
Before we get started, I just want to remind listeners about our email address where you can send comments, questions, and expressions of appreciation and outrage. That address is xxgabfest@slate.com. After our last show, we got a bunch of emails taking us to task about our patronizing take on hashtag activism, or as one smart letter writer put it, hashtag condescending, hashtag missed the point. Are we too used to the Slate counterintuitive mindset that we miss the essential goodness in earnest expressions of frustration and anger? Perhaps. So, thanks for pointing that out. Rebecca Heller said we should invite people who actually understand science onto the show when we discuss science-related topics, which also may be a good suggestion.
Which science-related topic?
Menstruation.
Oh.
Scientific. But generally, I do concede my own complete and total ignorance of science, so I'm a little...
I feel like it's a stretch to categorize menstruation as a science. I mean, we certainly have screwed up science topics before, probably, but I feel confident saying I'm relatively expert in menstruation. Number of years of experience, you know?
I think menstruation may have been the straw that broke that particular camel's back, rather than the actual inciting...
The tampon that broke the camel's
back. Exactly.
You made a bloody mess of it.
But sorry, men who are listening. The men, we know you skipped over that whole segment.
Well, see, but many wrote to say that they did not. And there was lots of positive response to our discussion of menstruation. And Amy Wicks recommended what she says is a great documentary about menstruation called The Mood Inside You. And Isaac, a dude who plays Dungeons and Dragons with five women, said that they often talk about their periods in front of him, which I interpreted as they're paying him a great compliment. And I really wish that Chris Wade was here today, who's also a brother, Dungeons and Dragons brother.
It's a compliment because it denotes their comfort.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's my interpretation.
That's good. Yeah.
One thing I want to point out, if you ever need more information about the stories and the items that we discuss on the podcast, you can find that information on our show page, which is slate.com/XX. Thanks again to everyone who wrote in, and please do let us know what you think of the show. The address, again, is xxgabfest@slate.com. Okay, our three topics for today are Laverne Cox and the transgender moment. Second, we'll dissect Slender Man, the internet meme said to have inspired at least two violent attacks by teenage girls. And finally, we'll gab about the joys and pains of dating tech guys. We are at a transgender tipping point, or so declared the cover of Time magazine a week or so ago. I should also note that E.J. Graff made a similar point in Newsweek 9 months earlier, and Eliza Gray also had a cover story in The New Republic on trans issues, 2 years ago, so quite some time ago. Laverne Cox, the trans actress from Orange is the New Black, was on the cover of Time. Janet Mock has had a best-selling book. Medicare will soon cover gender reassignment surgery, so we are finally realizing that genitalia isn't destiny. Noreen, does it feel to you that we are indeed now at that kind of tipping point?
Well, it depends what you mean by tipping point. Are we at a point where actual legislative change is happening? I don't think so. Maybe I'm incorrect, but are we at a point where we're putting a transgender woman on the cover of Time? Yeah, we are. Although the article, I read the article expecting to learn a lot about Laverne Cox and her life, and it really just was a picture of her with a speech that she had given about transgender rights. Like, I didn't learn anything about her story from the article. So, you know, that maybe is a symbol that we are still thinking of transgender people as in some ways symbols rather than people. Like, you know, you put an actress on the cover of Time, but you don't tell us anything about her.
There was an interview inside, I mean, certainly on the Time.com website. But yeah, I mean, I think it was very much, the piece itself was kind of a gloss on, you know, it was like Trans 101, I think.
Mm-hmm. The piece felt very introductory.
Yeah.
Which maybe, you know, is still needed.
Yeah.
Right? Like, people still say ignorant thing. They still willfully use the wrong gender pronoun. I've probably screwed up the gender pronoun thing in attempting, you know, to talk about trans people. But people still have a lot of misunderstandings and misapprehensions about trans people.
I mean, I think the key to editing a piece like that or writing a piece like that is the same as writing or editing any piece intended for a general interest audience. You're imagining yourself as at a cocktail party, and the person on one side knows everything about what you're talking about, and the person on another side knows absolutely nothing about your subject matter. You're trying to somehow keep both of their attentions. It's really like a universal dilemma, and I feel like this piece privileged the person who knows absolutely nothing over the person who might have come to it even as an Orange is the New Black fan who wanted to know more about Laverne Cox, exactly as you just said, Noreen. But I think the symbolic power of putting a transgender actress on the cover of Time, you know, can't be understated in terms of just total mainstream, middle of the road signifier of, you know, an issue and a person worthy of everyone's attention. It has its own power, even if the article didn't quite follow through.
Just this morning, I was listening to this week's Savage Love Cast, which is Dan Savage's fantastic podcast, which everybody should be listening to. It really is amazing. And he usually starts with a rant, I think you could call it. And this week, he literally talked for 18 minutes about an occasion. He was at an off-the-record session at a university, and some trans activists in the audience yelled at him, said that he was transphobic. And partly it was about his use of the word tranny, which is kind of a flashpoint right now. It has been a word that has been used in the gay community, not necessarily even referring to trans people. But, you know, there's kind of a history of using it. And it, you know, it's part of that whole reclaiming vocabulary movement. And some trans activists are very angry about it. Others, like MX Justin Bond and Lady Bunny and Kate Bornstein, are not so, actually think that it's, you know, maybe not such a good idea to be quite so policing of language. But just the fact that, you know, that this is going on, that there was an incident with RuPaul over the use of shemale in RuPaul's Drag Race. I've certainly felt kind of nervous, kind of, you know, oh, I've made mistakes. I've felt like I needed to be educated, you know, as someone who's worked in gay issues for many years. And I think just the fact that we are in this moment where some of us are experiencing discomfort in areas where we usually kind of feel, oh, I'm okay on this. That signifies that we are in some period of transition or change, which is always a little bit challenging, but also, you know, I think we could say probably not, I think maybe definitely on the whole is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a reason that Laverne Cox is being sort of celebrated as a symbol of this movement and not RuPaul?
Well, I mean, she is trans. He isn't. I mean, he's a drag queen. But I think the fact
I just revealed my own ignorance that, like, I need to reread that timepiece.
But that's exactly why these kinds of conversations are good. I mean, the shemale controversy on RuPaul's Drag Race surprised me. I'm a huge fan of RuPaul's Drag Race. They've been doing You've Got Shemale. They've been doing that segment since the beginning. And when people started to, you know, raise it as an issue, it just hadn't occurred to me before that it could be offensive to a whole community of people. And so I think exactly those kinds of uncomfortable, surprising conversations are really healthy. And, you know, we're all going to learn a lot in a short period of time.
And I do think that I agree completely. And certainly a part of this moment that I think we're having is that there are lots of really good books that are coming out. I just read, or really I couldn't claim to read it. I flipped through this amazing new book called Trans Bodies, Trans Selves, which is a very conscious echo of Our Bodies, Ourselves, you know, the classic women's health book put out by the Boston Women's Health Book Collective now decades ago. And it's just this amazing resource about trans issues, you know, for trans people, I guess, but also just for anybody who has a question or is interested. You know, I think this book is going to save lives and also just kind of answer a lot of questions. One of the things that I think a lot of people are experiencing is just like, can I ask about this? Who can I ask? Is it okay? And, you know, there's lots of information in that book, more sort of voicey things, like T. Cooper had a book recently called, I think, Real Men Adventures. That was great. Esper Bergman's work is very helpful. In Outward, we've had some good pieces by Kristen Malloy. So, you know, there are more opportunities to kind of learn. But also, I think, Laverne, to get back to your original question, Noreen, Laverne Cox was on the cover of Time because she's beautiful, because she's very striking. She's 6 feet tall. She, you know, is really good in Orange is the New Black, although she doesn't really get a whole lot to do in season two. I was a little sorry
spoiler
to see.
Spoiler alert. I've only watched two episodes so far.
She's in it. She just, you know, she
wore a great dress in episode one or two.
Two. At the work fair. Yeah. And she has, not to spoil anything, but she has a nice moment a little further on in season two where she gives some of the other inmates a lesson about their anatomy. That's really, really helpful for all of them.
No, well, that was helpful to me. Thank you.
I think another reason why Laverne Cox is the one is because in season one, she had that incredibly strong and compelling episode where we learn about Sophia, her character's backstory. Mm-hmm. And we meet her wife and her son, and we find out why she is in prison. She's in prison, spoiler for season one, sorry guys, because of credit card fraud, which she was doing to fund her surgery for her transition. That episode was not only very well written and beautifully performed, not only by Laverne Cox, but by her twin brother, who was playing the pre-transition Sophia. But it exemplified what Orange is the New Black does, which is it completely humanizes and three-dimensionalizes people who our society tends to dehumanize and cast in the margins, which is inmates. But coincidentally, we also happen to do that to transgender people, as a certain piece in National Review proved quite disgustingly recently, and we don't have to talk about that. But I think she's such a strong character in season one. Everyone fell in love with her, and it was probably a lot of people's first interaction with a transgender character. So I think that was a big breakthrough for a lot of people.
We should maybe talk about the National Review piece, shouldn't we?
I guess. I mean, it was, I think, a kind of horrible piece by Kevin D. Williamson.
Mm-hmm. Kevin D. Williamson, name and shame.
Yeah. That is a man who does deserve some trans shaming or some shaming.
Absolutely.
Just generally. A piece where he repeatedly referred to Laverne Cox as he, who talked about gender reassignment surgery as, what, mutilation and... I don't know. I mean, just horrible words. He basically, it was, as Mark Joseph Stern did a great piece in Outward about, you know, essentially how that piece set out to and, you know, really made every effort to dehumanize Laverne Cox and other trans people. I mean, and certainly the fact that Kevin Williamson is still defending that piece and still saying things like biology is real. And I mean, certainly that shows that it's not just that, yeah, I mean, National Review does happen to be a right-wing publication, but it's not that crazy, or rather, he's not some weird outlier. A lot of people actually do believe that trans is a delusion. And
yeah, that's why I wanted to talk about it. I'm quoting here from Eliza Gray's 2011 story in The New Republic. She wrote, "Transgender people are some of the least protected, most persecuted people in the United States. In a recent study of transgender students, nearly half said they've been punched, kicked, or injured with a weapon at least once in the last year. On average, a transgender person is murdered because of their identity every month, according to the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund. Transgender people are regularly evicted from their homes, fired from their jobs, and denied medical treatment. Many health insurance plans only cover procedures for one gender, so a person born male who transitions to female can't get both a prostate check and a mammogram." So I think, like, we should talk about the Kevin Williamson piece because he is, in some ways, I don't want to call him the norm,
right?
But he's not the most hateful person in America on this issue. And I just want to talk about why. Like, yeah. Why is he so afraid of it? Is he afraid of the idea that someone wouldn't want to be a man anymore? Like, there seems to me, like, and maybe I'm wrong, but, like, there might be more hatred for people who transition from male to female. Or maybe it's just that there might be more of those people, or it just might be we talk about it more. But there really seemed to be something going on where he just, like, was angry about that. In some way, it was threatening to his own manhood.
Right. I mean, I do think that in many cases, that it's much more possible for female-to-male trans people to pass, which, you know, mm-hmm. may or may not be a goal for people. We may all know some trans guys and not know that they're trans guys, whereas we may also know some trans women, but it's just, it's much more difficult, again, if that's a goal. I'm not saying that it is, but for them to pass them, for them to be stealth, I mean, it's just a lot harder. But yeah, I mean, it must be some deep misogyny or discomfort. I mean, I have to say, and you know, this is a kind of a confession, that I've found myself experiencing that thought of, like, you know, why are you pushing yourself through this? Why, you know, why, kind of questioning, is it just a delusion? Are you going to regret it? I mean, thoughts that, you know, you kind of need to move through because the answer is no and no. You know, I kind of I'm familiar with that feeling of questioning. But then, of course, he just had no respect. And so he just kind of stuck to his own views instead of listening to trans people, which seems like it is a really important part of what we need to do.
Well, I think the why are you putting yourself through this question answers itself. If
yes.
you're putting yourself through this incredibly difficult journey, it must be incredibly important
yes.
and urgent and not feel like a choice. So that question is easy for a you know, relatively clueless cisgender person like myself. I think a lot of the contempt from that part of society, like Kevin Williamson, comes from just base scientific ignorance. Mm-hmm. He thinks, he assumes, with no further investigation on his part, that he is coming from basic scientific truths about the binaries of sex and gender, and he doesn't bother to get a book out or call an actual expert to check that his binaries are really binaries. And so the contempt stems from what he calls a delusion, when he is actually the deluded one. I mean, the scientific establishment, which is not necessarily the most progressive, you know, sector of any given society, is completely against him on everything on this point. Maybe not, you know, maybe not our government, maybe not legislatively, but scientifically, everything is stacked against him. But he just can't get out of his own bubble. And so he wants to push everyone into another bubble where they're all deluded. And it's just, I don't know. It's so noxious. It's so disgusting to me that it's hard to even I understand the societal benefit of trying to get inside his head and empathize with where he's coming from. Like, you do have to understand the opposition, but it's just, I guess this issue is as simple to me as it is to him. And I guess why these fights become so intractable. But
Well, I'm going to take it to a really lowbrow place and say that the reason that I think a lot of America is talking about transgender issues right now is not, in fact, Laverne Cox on the cover of Time, but it's the fact that J-Lo's husband was caught texting with a, or liking Instagram photos of a transvestite, and it supposedly precipitated their divorce. So readers...
Casper?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I watched a lot of E! This past weekend, and I also went to the nail salon and got... So I'm, like, really up on celebrity gossip. Yeah, but a huge divorce. Yeah,
big time. So the trans spectrum is also responsible for J-Lo's divorce?
Yeah. Crazy, wow. Right?
Were they married?
Okay, maybe it's a breakup. God.
Okay.
Ill-informed today.
There's also a spectrum between breakup and divorce. So, you know, there's lots of spectrums. We need to become comfortable with spectrums instead of binaries, people.
Exactly.
That'd be the big takeaway. All right, let's move on to our second topic, which is Slender Man. On May 31st, two 12-year-old girls in Waukesha, Wisconsin, which is, by the way, the very first American town that I ever visited. I spent my first American summer there. Love Waukesha, Wisconsin. But anyway, two 12-year-old girls in Waukesha, Wisconsin, stabbed another 12-year-old girl 19 times to please a mythological creature they had learned about online. That creature was Slender Man, a tall, thin, human-like figure who, according to its creator, is a shapeshifter, that's really hard to say, who compels your gaze. Another girl in Ohio this time is also said to have attacked someone to please Slender Man. Noreen, you were once a 12-year-old Midwesterner. What is going on here? And does the internet have some special power to make tweens murderous?
I feel so complicit suddenly in this. What is going on here? Well, I'm not sure. My first reaction on reading about this case wasn't the reaction that I think a lot of people have had, which is that the internet, it's like the dark woods of every fairy tale. You go in and who knows what's going to happen. My first reaction was that adolescence is such a weird and intense time. And the fact that these girls who were seemingly normal in every other way, like, suddenly killed their friend. Middle school girls backstab their friends in the metaphorical sense all the time. But this was really, I'm not trying to make light of this. This was really just like, to an extreme version, seemed like the twisted version of, like, whatever is happening in girl friendships at that particular age. I mean, it's just a really, really unfortunate. It ruined three people's lives.
We should say that the 12-year-old that they stabbed did survive, but she was very close, apparently, to being stabbed fatally.
The blade missed her aorta by a millimeter or something, but she's been discharged from the hospital.
Good.
And she's going to be okay. But the emotional trauma must be. And I was really shocked that the 12-year-old girls, the two girls involved in the attack, they're going to be tried as adults. As of right now, they're being tried as adults. That could change. But 12 years old, I mean, I'm not discounting the horror of what they did, but 12 years old, I mean, your brain is still developing. I can't imagine that will hold.
There is something about internet memes and scariness and things that, you know, I'm sure people go absolutely down these rabbit holes and just become obsessed. I mean, clearly they do. And it not that they all or any other people are driven to, you know, attempt murder as part of it. But
Matthew J.X. Malady, Slate's Good Word columnist, recently wrote an essay for Slate titled "The Internet Doesn't Love Anything." And in the essay, he criticizes our tendency. And I do think it's more than a semantic tendency to personify this non-living thing that connects computer networks and computer facilities and assigns it human characteristics and desires. So it's like we invest the internet with the same power that we invest the Slender Man with power.
Right.
A lot of the experts quoted in the pieces following this terrible attack pointed out that these girls could have gotten this story from anywhere.
Yeah.
They could have gotten it from a book of folklore. They could have gotten it from a movie. They could have gotten it from an oral history tradition that predates the internet by thousands of years, at least. What it reminded a lot of people of was that movie Heavenly Creatures.
Yes,
directed
that's exactly
by,
what was in my mind.
Peter Jackson, pre-Lord of the Rings, pre-Hobbit. And what Heavenly Creatures is so good at doing is, you know, it's two girls. They're a little older. They're 14 or 15. And, you know, they have this incredibly intense friendship and they fall down this rabbit hole of imagination and these movie star characters that they're beholden to. And it's this, like, very expressionist portrait of a really intense female friendship that implodes under its own pressure. You know, it collapses under its own weight. And in Heavenly Creatures, it collapses in this just horrifying, bloody way. And for most 14-year-olds, those relationships collapse just because you just can't take it anymore.
I just want to mention that the woman who... one of the murderous girls grew up to be the writer. What's her name?
I think Juliet Holm grew up to be Anne Perry.
That's right.
Who's a very prolific genre writer.
Yeah, she's a mystery writer and apparently mm-hmm. a very good one who now lives in, not in New Zealand, but in Scotland, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Huh, that's fascinating.
Yeah. But I totally understand why Slender Man has such narrative power. I don't understand why he has homicidal power, but that's probably a good thing. Like, mm-hmm. if you look at how the narrative has been pieced together, you'll have these very straight-sounding news reports about Slender Man with specific names and specific dates attached to his victims, and everything feels cobbled together in fragments. So it's almost like, not to get too academic about it, but it privileges like off-screen space in the same way that a horror movie does, because you don't have the whole picture. And so the things that you're seeing in a horror movie, sorry, that was really film studies.
Keep going.
That was good.
But like the things that you aren't seeing or the things that you think you're about to see are always scarier than what mm-hmm. you're actually seeing. And then the other thing about the Slender Man is that he's like right in that sweet spot of the uncanny valley where he looks human, but you know he's not human, and he's kind of elegant and he has those attenuated limbs. And
also none of us had ever heard of him before.
No.
Right?
Like, so it was this total secret world that was right under our noses the whole time. And that definitely intensifies its power. I sound like I'm being very flip about this horrible thing that happened, but I kind of understand how he could hold someone in his thrall.
I was listening to another Slate podcast, The Gist. I guess this must have been Tuesday, because he was talking about the shooting in Nevada, the couple who had ties to that crazy, what's that crazy rancher's name?
Clive and Bundy.
Yeah. His theory, or maybe an expert's theory that he was quoting that seems true to me, is that we connect these mass shootings in this case, a stabbing, these horrible events with these larger movements in cases where we are already angry about the movement, maybe. Mm. It's easier to grapple with that. So, you know, crazy right-wingers, like, this gives us, you know, another thing to pin on them. In the case of the California shooter who we talked about last time on the podcast, you know, that gave us a space, like a reason to talk about all the horrible misogyny that, you know, is going on in so many other ways. In this case, it gives us a chance to talk about the ways that the internet scares us, mm-hmm. you know, and like the unknown things about the internet. And it's an easy place to place the blame and to help us make sense of our own feelings.
Yeah, and it is very comforting almost to find a narrative that we can, you know, place this in some kind of, it's part of folk tales, it's part of kids scaring themselves instead of just, it's violent kids, mm-hmm. or it's a kid who gave in to violence or mm-hmm. something, or an adult, whatever.
It helps us I can't understand the psychology of a 12-year-old girl who tries to kill her friend. I just can't. But the psychology of someone who goes to a dark place on the internet and then, you know, like maybe isn't so happy about the way her life is a few hours later, I can kind of understand that.
And starts to lose track of her reality outside of it, and the two realities start to blur.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I think a lot of people can understand that if you frame it that way.
Indeed. Listeners, I would like to now move your reality to the recently launched membership program Slate Plus. I think of it as a way for superfans to express their love for the magazine. For $5 a month or $50 a year, you can get access to special features. For example, last week when David Haglund published his great long read about Delonte West, he did some great extras on Slate Plus, a talk with his editor about how they shape the story, explanation of his attempts to contact his subject, and something that might be of special interest to podcast listeners. He read the 10,000-word piece aloud and made it available as a podcast to Slate Plus members. You can find ad-free podcasts, podcasts, special podcasts like the discussion of Game of Thrones that Dan Coyce and Willa Paskin do have after every episode, and a weekly roundup from a rotating cast of Slate editors and writers of their favorite stories from the previous 7 days. There are all kinds of fun features, and if you'd like to check it out, please go to slate.com/XX+. If you use that URL, the powers that be will know that you support the XX Gabfest, and that is a good thing. So, our final topic today is the pleasures and pains of dating tech guys. Two recent articles, one by Maureen O'Connor in New York Magazine, one by Tricia Romano in Dame Magazine, tackled this topic. O'Connor was one of 16 female residents of New York who were flown out to San Francisco by the website Dating Ring to date tech guys. And Romano claimed that Amazon is killing her sex life because it's responsible for bringing thousands of young, socially awkward, work-obsessed guys to the city. Noreen, as the XX Gabfest designated dater, what did you make of these pieces?
Well, I made you guys talk about this topic because it just struck me as a funny moment where it's become okay to, like, just mock the dating pool? The dating pool, but also the lack of aptitude for dating that this, like, whole large swath of men had. Like, it's this...
Supposedly has,
you know, these people who the press is obsessed with and, you know, they're making all kinds of money and in many ways they rule the world. There's this, like, tiny little genre of pieces, and also on Silicon Valley on HBO, there was a couple episode arc where dating or gender relations at least were part of it. Anyway, there's this, like, moment where it just seems like a small stab of revenge. The rest of the culture is, like, getting back at tech guys by writing about how terrible right. they are to date. Like, they might have money, they might have equity, but you don't want to, like, sit across from them at a dinner table.
I thought the Dame piece felt very ad hominem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We should talk about what the arguments against, you know, that they make about tech guys are. I mean, it seems like they say they're, this woman says they're boring and sort of beige and khaki clad, and they only talk about, I mean, I think there are a couple different arguments in the piece that they're, they only talk about work.
They only talk about their jobs. They only talk about tech.
Yeah. She said they had poor social skills, not a lot of style, were unattractive. She said there were sevens looking for tens.
They're incurious. They don't ask you about you. They only talk about themselves.
Well, the sevens looking for ten thing cracked me up because the only time I've heard that, actually, and then she says, and they think they're 11s or
something
like that.
Right, and they think they're 11s,
but that cracked me up because the only time I've heard the phrase, so do you guys know the phrase, they're 7-11s? Have you ever heard that?
No.
It's they're sevens, but they think they're 11s. And it was a tech guy that I know talking about San Francisco, the women in San Francisco. So this woman who was called, and I think it's like sort of a thing. I don't think he came up with it himself. It's like a thing guys say. And so this woman was then just like spinning that back on the men. First of all, seven's like pretty high up there.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, seven's like a good rating. Uh-huh. But I just thought it was funny that she had done that in that way.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I did not recognize her description of Seattle. I have now lived in New York for 9 years, but I spent 15 years in Seattle before that, and I worked at Microsoft. I am familiar with tech people, and I wasn't dating guys, but I know them, and I just didn't recognize her description of the city or of the sort of social milieu. Then also, for her and her straight friends to go to Pony, a great gay bar, which is actually owned by a former Slate intern, which has on its door a sign that says, "This is a gay bar, a very gay bar. If you're not a queer or a queer admirer, don't come in here."
And I know that from Ask a Homo.
Exactly.
Which everyone should be watching on Slate.com.
Yeah, really featuring should. June Thomas. Featuring
and
June
Brian Lauder. I don't know. There was something about it that, like, it just, there were so many things that, like, I don't know, this isn't my experience. Now, I'm not questioning her reality, but I don't know.
And compounding that, I think, is her nostalgia for the Seattle that she used to know.
Right, right.
A lot of her disappointment with these beige, you know, unstylish, pasty guys who can only talk about themselves and about tech. And by the way, I mean, the idea that talking about technology or apps or, you know, compression software, whatever they're talking to her about, is the kind of talk that, and I'm quoting, makes vaginas clamp shut, unquote. is pretty limiting of women's interests. Like, women work in tech, women are interested in tech. So, you know, she's making blanket assumptions about women as well as men. And I should, I have a disclaimer here. I know Tricia Romano a little bit. We used to work at the Village Voice together, and I remain a fan of her work, if not a fan of this piece. But
yeah, and ditto. I don't know her, but I've enjoyed her byline. But yeah, this piece just seems
but
crazy.
She has this nostalgia for the Seattle of sort of
the 90s,
early to mid 90s, when computer programming was like a cool alt slacker thing to do. And it wasn't about making money and getting equity. And, you know, she has this fixed idea of what she wants Seattle to be. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I empathize with that. Everyone has nostalgia for different points in their life. I also think that just dating is hard in general. I haven't done it in a long time. But I think everyone, when they're on the dating scene, does have these stretches, days or weeks or whatever it is, where it's like, I don't like any of these guys. They're all the same. I'm so sick of this. They never ask about me. They don't dress the way I want them to dress or whatever. And I think you've got to get that out. But, you know, get it out to your girlfriend. Don't turn it into faux journalism. I mean, she quoted a lot of people.
Right.
But all the people she quotes think exactly the way she does. Mm-hmm. And I sort of wish that she had tried to find people who are actually, I mean, I guess it wouldn't have supported her thesis, but there are people out there, we know them, who, you know, are having an easier time of it on the dating circuit in Seattle or San Francisco or wherever.
I mean, it also seemed that she was blaming Amazon or blaming tech guys for other things. You know, she was projecting all of the ills as she sees them onto the guys in the dating pool. For example, gentrification is a big issue in Seattle. I mean, having successful companies is great for your city unless you're trying to find an apartment. And, you know, also San Francisco and Seattle are both very gay cities. That's going to affect the male-to-female ratio. There are many things that are going on in these cities, and tech is one of them. You know, Seattle has been a tech city since the founding of Microsoft. It's not all about Amazon, but sure, you know, I know what she's doing. But.
Okay, well, I was going to defend tech guys against, you know, your cruel onslaught, but you guys have defended, so now I have to, like, attack tech guys viciously here. There's a very funny line in Maureen O'Connor's piece where she's, you know, she's at one of these mixers. She's been flown out with all these other women to meet tech guys. I'll just read from it because her words are excellently crafted. In an affectless voice, he analyzes the relative Asian-ness of each of my facial features, then explains his frustration with online dating. Quote, I prefer to use reality as my platform. There is zero latency, no lag. Do you know what lag is? When you do something online, you don't get a response right away. Meeting women in reality, boom, fully responsive. As he says this, he begins to touch me. I flee. So she is...
Maureen O'Connor, take a bow.
Right? But, okay, so the argument that she is making, and I think in a different way Tricia Romano is making, is that there is something about this industry, which, by the way, is very heavily male.
Very heavily
especially
male.
In technical positions, mm-hmm. that has left these men who are, you know, men of means, ambition, you know, they are, you know, have a fortune and are in want of a wife to, like, make it very Austenian. They are, like, utterly ill-prepared to actually woo someone in a way that would work. And maybe there is something to that. I don't know.
Yeah.
I haven't actually gone out with a tech guy, which maybe that should be a goal. But, you know, do you guys think there's something to that?
When people talk about the brogrammer stereotype, I think they're often talking in terms of like base misogyny.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm looking at Silicon Valley as an example, mm-hmm. which is probably the closest I will get to
sure, rather than the geographic area.
Yes, the HBO program, not the geographic area. The issue with those guys is that they're in this homosocial hothouse environment.
Mm-hmm.
They're not interacting with other women. They're not interacting with anyone who doesn't work with them on the same very specific work-related issues of lag and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
They're eating badly. They're sleeping badly. They're under a lot of stress. And they're just sort of temporarily stunted in ways that might turn into permanently stunted.
Much like investment bankers.
Sure.
And, you know, they were the bad stereotype in an earlier
Absolutely.
Era.
There's any number of people you can fit into this box. And so, and given their schedules, you know, they can't really sustain a relationship unless they do what Guilfoyle, and Guilfoyle is probably the most confident ladies' man on the show. Guilfoyle's girlfriend just installs herself in that grubby house where they're living, which, like, who would want to do that? And so when Dinesh had a wonderful little storyline in the last two episodes where, spoiler alert, he thinks he's infatuated with a girl, the girl from Cupcakely, the cupcake app, but he's actually infatuated with her code, which Guilfoyle has written. And so when Dinesh is gazing at her, he's gazing at a unicorn, you know, and I realize I realize that unicorn has a different connotation in the tech world, but he's looking at a magical unicorn, and a unicorn is beautiful and wondrous and a little scary, and you're not sure it's real and maybe there's lag, but, you know, it's not a person. And I think we all unicornize people to a certain extent when we're falling in love, but I think that kind of hothouse environment intensifies it. I am probably giving tech guys too much credit. Maybe women aren't unicorns to them. Maybe they are something less attractive. I don't really know.
Well, there's sevens who think they're 11. Come on, bro.
Well, there are definitely, I think, performance aspects to this. I mean, there are sort of traits that tech guys are thought to have and maybe sometimes have, but I think a lot of the time people perform those traits because that is, you know, what a tech guy is supposed to be. So they may not actually be interested in, I mean, I don't know, name five things that tech guys are associated with. Lag, latency, Dungeons and Dragons, you know, compression algorithms. And but they play that out because it's part of the, you know, the magic that's associated with them that makes women, you know, in theory, interested in them, mm-hmm. You know, part of which is that they're going to get rich, which is probably not true for many of them. I mean, they have a job for now, but it's a world that changes very quickly. Their skills
Thomas
might not
is stay. Calling a tech bubble right now, investors. sell.
I'm calling a bubble in tech guys. And, you know, I thought it was really interesting in Maureen O'Connor's piece that she investigated why the guys were there. Why did they go on these weird dates? Because, you know, their time is very precious. And these were bizarre, a sort of bizarre situation with these women being flown in. It was like something out of the, you know, the turn of the century. And it turns out that they weren't actually interested in the dates. They were interested in getting access to becoming an investor in the dating company, Dating Ring, which was a Y Combinator company, which is very hard to get in on. So as she puts it, for every tech guy struggling to find love in San Francisco, there is one struggling harder to find novel ways to spend his money. So that everybody has all kinds of motivations. I don't know. We're all completely living through illusions at all time. We're all delusional in many ways and sort of projecting things onto tech guys is just one of these many ways.
Right. And one thing actually, and, you know, I'm going to cherry pick a few cases here, but it seems like actually the sort of most successful tech guys who are in the press a lot, the Mark Zuckerbergs, the, you know, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, they actually seem to marry women who are extremely successful in their own right, who don't seem to have gone after them for the money. They really seem to have sought out companionate marriages with challenging, ambitious women. So, you know, maybe there's one thing that's happening in reality and there's another thing that we are sort of making fun of in trend pieces, or maybe just there are a bunch of different things that are happening with dating in the tech world. But I just wanted to point that out.
All right, let's move on to our recommendations. Jessica, what do you have?
So my recommendation is a game, and it's not at all new. It's been around for, I think, a year and a half, but it was new to me as of this week, and it might be of interest especially to fans of Orange is the New Black. It's called Prison Architect.
Wow.
Stay with
I
me.
Just have this image of you at home building prisons on your phone. Is that what's
that
happening?
That image
here?
Is an accurate one,
Maureen. Oh, my God.
Prison Architect is available on Steam, and technically speaking, it's a construction and management simulation game, which sounds boring, but you are in charge of running a prison.
How did you get into this?
My husband. Hi, Adrian. he's really, really into it, and he got me really, really
into
it.
How did he get into this? Is he like a prison?
Well, my brother-in-law works for Rockstar, so he is all over like the coolest indie games and stuff. So that's how we benefit from that.
Hot tips straight from
Lincoln, England. Anyway, Prison Architect is amazing. You can lay out your facility and build it from scratch. You can build your cells, your showers, your yards, your staff rooms, your morgues, your armories, your kennels, your kitchens. You can even build a solitary unit or the shoe.
So instead of the Sims, it's the cells or something. It's just like really, you know, you can have your own universe, but it's...
This is my introduction to these CMS games. I've never played one before, so I'm sure listeners who are familiar with these kinds of games are like yawning, like, yes, I know how this works, but it was just completely new and exciting to me. You can apply for grants to start up behavioral therapy programs or methadone programs. The more inmates you have and the more dangerous they are, the more money you get to spend. And then all of your prisoners, just like on Orange is the New Black, they have a biography and a backstory and a release date. And if you mismanage the prison, there are consequences. The inmates need skyrocket, and you might have to call in the riot squad. And then best of all, if you're feeling ambitious, if you're up for a little bit of basic coding or Photoshop work, or if you're married to someone who's up for a little basic coding and Photoshop work, you can customize the look of the prison and the look of the inmates. So you can totally make your own little lich field with like red in the kitchen and Pensatucky in the laundry.
Slenderman as porn stash.
No, Slenderman. Oh, yeah. Yeah, actually, Slenderman could play Porn Stash. I'm going on and on. Prison Architect. It's totally addictive, and it's on Steam.
Wow.
I am going to recommend a TV show. Shocker! Playing House, which is a comedy on the USA Network, and it stars Lennon Parham and Jessica St. Clair, who are two real-life best friends who've actually often worked together.
Oh, they had that show.
Friends Forever, I think it was
called.
Was
that what it was called?
I think so.
Well, that's a terrible title. No wonder it got canceled. But it was really good.
They've had a bunch of shows, and I think they always play best friends because it's just so much a part of who they are, and they do it really well. And in this show, they are once again besties. One of them is having a baby. Her husband is useless. And so one of them moves from her high-powered job in Shanghai to their hometown to help her with the baby. And it's really sweet, but it's very funny, and it has some very familiar faces who are doing great work, including Keegan-Michael Key of Key & Peele and Zach Woods, who is in everything these days, including Silicon Valley, Veep, and The Good Wife.
And I love Zach Woods.
Yeah, and he's very Zach Woodian. He actually plays a character called Zach on Playing House. Noreen, what do you want us to read, watch, or listen to?
I just read a book. It's a short-ish book called The Days of Abandonment by Elena Ferrante. Have you guys read this or heard of it?
No.
It's translated from the Italian, which is not like a thing that I do normally. It's like, read books translated from the Italian.
You read them in the original.
Exactly.
Sure.
I, in fact, translate them myself for a mass audience. No. I guess Elena Ferrante is a very well-known and... well known but also not known in Italy. She's somewhat of a mysterious figure, but she's famous. Anyway, it's a book about a woman who has been, you know, her husband has left her for a much younger woman, and she unravels, and it's just the most vivid, graphic, but also elegant vision of a woman becoming undone. And I don't normally go in for these kind of books. it's for a book club. You know, I've outed myself as a book club member on here before. It was just really good and really gripping, and I read it super quickly. So Days of Abandonment by Elena Ferrante.
Thank you.
That sounds great.
It really does. Well, that is another show. Thanks to Andrea Salenzi for recording today's podcast, which I'll be producing. Many thanks to our intern, Laura Smith, and to Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. Remember to send your comments to xxgabfest@slate.com for Jessica Winter. Thank you so much for being with us these last 2 weeks.
Thank you, June and Noreen.
And Noreen Malone, I'm June Thomas. We'll be back with you in 2 weeks' time.